This is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31, 2021, at PCC's Cascade Campus Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
Is your organization planning a virtual event? Looking for a media co-sponsorship? Then contact KBOO today. KBOO's community media co-sponsorships provide free on-air promos for local nonprofits and small organizations, as well as a listing on our website's community calendar and promotions on our social media. For more information and to apply, visit kbu.fm/co-sponsorships today.
Welcome. You're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than right now. And KBOO needs your help. You can donate via the KBOO website at kbu.fm/give or kbu.fm/donate. There's also a donate button. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. We know times are hard, a lot of people are facing financial hardships, but any little bit you can contribute helps. So donate whatever you can for the radio station you know and love online at kbu.fm/give. Keep us on the air. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. As a latecomer to this region, I thank the Indigenous peoples of the Portland area for their stewardship of this land. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, bands of the Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia River, creating communities and summer encampments to harvest and use the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and others, and KBOO thanks them. I have a guest this month, but first I'm going to read a couple of poems by Sandra Cisneros. Poet, novelist, essayist, short story writer, and children's author, Sandra Cisneros was born in Chicago, Illinois, and earned a BA at Loyola University of Chicago and an MFA at the University of Iowa. She's the author of several poetry collections, including Loose Woman, 1994, which I'm going to read from, My Wicked, Wicked Ways, 1987, and Bad Boys, 1980. Apparently, she doesn't write books about good people. Cisneros is also the author of several children's books, including Hares or Pelitos. Her work has been translated into more than a dozen languages. She received the National Medal of the Arts from President Obama in 2016, and her many other honors include a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, Texas Medal of the Arts, fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts in both poetry and fiction, etc., etc. She's the founding president of the Macondo Foundation and the Alfredo Cisneros Del Moral Foundation. And I'm going to read two poems by her. This is Little Clown, My Heart. Little clown, my heart, spangled again and lopsided, handstands and Peking pirouettes, backflips snapping open like a carpenter's hinged ruler. Little gimp-footed hooray, paper parasol of pleasures, fleshy under-tongue of sorrows, sweet potato plant of my addictions. Acapulco cliff diver Corazon, fine as an obsidian dagger. Alley-oop, and here we go, into the froth, my life, into the flames. And that was Little Clown, My Heart by Sandra Cisneros. And now I'm going to read a few items to consider. First, there is the scent of barley to remember, barley and rain, the smooth terrain to recollect and savor, unforgiving whiteness of the room, ambiguity of linen, purity, mute and still as photographs on the moon. Everything here must be analyzed, cataloged, studied twice, a painstaking arrangement, almost vain. Brandy glass with its one amber eye on the bedside table, shirt draped across the chair, woolen trousers folded neatly in a square, little clock repeating, precise, precise, not a stray whisker, no comb full of dead hair, no cup filled with coins and cufflinks and fingernail clippers, a scrupulous chess game, formal, concise. There is much to learn, grace of the neck to memorize, heliotrope of sleep, hieroglyph of bones to decipher. Love, if at all, comes later. For now, the hands take to their dialogue, gullible as foreigners, a greedy chattering endlessly on nothing, nothing at all. That was A Few Items to Consider by Sandra Cisneros. This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. And now I'd like to introduce my guest, Maddie Nguyen. Maddie Nguyen is a Vietnamese-American actor, playwright, and poet currently based in Portland, Oregon. Having graduated from the University of Portland in 2020 with a degree in theater arts, Maddie has also been around the Portland theater scene quite a bit. 2018 Portland Fertile Ground Festival, 2019 Theater 33, and 2020 Northwest Theater Workshop, and she has a solo show, I Defy You Stars, coming up as part of the 2021 Portland Fertile Ground Festival, which will be streamed in February, and a production of her original Zoom play, The Guest, a Zoom play, How Timely Is That?, just recently premiered on December 18th, 2020. As a poet, she's participated in Slamlandia and Portland Poetry Slam since the summer of 2019. She was a competing poet in Slamlandia's Women of the World Poetry Slam finals in December 2020, and qualified for the semifinal slam in March 2020. And she's also a member of the parody folk band, the AA Asian American Batteries, along with her fellow musician, Katarina Yeo. So if you add a third person, are you going to be the AAA Batteries?
The AAA Batteries.
All right, so please welcome Maddie, and we'd like to hear some of your poetry.
Hi. This first one is, I'm very bad at titles, so this first one is called Getting High and Listening to Anais Mitchell's Cosmic American on Repeat for 2 hours. I'm afraid that I will always be such a clumsy human being, that my death will most definitely be brought about by missing the top of a flight of stairs, or falling off a chair, or accidentally finger spasming my way into liking an old Instagram photo of someone I am stalking and then immediately having to flee the country in order to save face. I'm afraid of my heart remaining as clumsy as my body, like a teenage boy who wakes up to find he has grown 5 inches overnight, who stumbles over his new gangly legs and accidentally elbows strangers on the subway because he doesn't recognize these unfamiliar limbs. I have never been a teenage boy, but I'm afraid that my heart is like one and that I don't understand it most of the time. I'm afraid of falling. I'm afraid that when I am scrolling through Instagram, trying not to like the photos of the people I am stalking, that behind these static snapshots of shared meals in foreign countries are strangers who feel just as close to falling apart as I do. Most days, I am afraid that most people carry around a certain slant of sadness that I cannot see, and it scares me to think that we are all so far apart, that the sun is closer to the moon than it is to any other star in the universe, and what it must feel like to see all of the things you are made of from a distance. I'm afraid that I will be writing about distance for the rest of my life and never have anything better to talk about than my tendency to trip over my words, my love tangled up like the cords of an alarm clock radio, and, can you hear me? Are you listening? I'm afraid that you might think this is about you. I'm afraid that one night the teenage boy that is my heart will wake up and want a glass of water, and he'll head downstairs, navigating steps that creak, and he'll try to be quiet so he won't disturb the parents he's afraid will yell at him for this midnight descent. And when he stands in the kitchen, fingers fumbling with ice and condensation on the glass through the window, he'll see his backyard and the way the moon peeks through the trees and how the light bends and twists to shine on the dark grass, and everything will be blue, even the grass, which grass is not supposed to be, but it is the color of moonlight, which isn't really light from the moon at all, but from the sun crossing time and distance to slant through the trees of the backyard of the teenage boy that is my heart, that is to say, the certain slant of light is just me, falling through the air with only the grass to catch me, to bruise me into blue till you won't recognize me, and I don't want you to. I'm afraid of posting a picture on Instagram of the moon and you not liking it, and the teenage boy that is my heart goes back to bed, folding himself back into himself to fit on his mattress, arms and legs tucked in. In the morning, when he wakes, his alarm radio will play a song that we both know too well. This is called A Memory, written at the beginning of quarantine for National Poetry Writing Month, actually. When the weather turns warm and track season starts, the boys my age develop sticky fingers, running off into the golden-dressed afternoon, returning with empty hands but mouths half full, half naked bodies glistening with sweat and fruit juice. The house on Buena Vista has a mango tree, they whisper between stretches, long limbed limb to long limbed limb. And if you can reach, the branches stretch over the wall. I am too small to touch the fruit, can barely keep up on the runs, my pathetic lungs struggling with every step. And the boys run too fast. They jump too high, scale the wall of the backyard of the house of Buena Vista before I can even blink. The flash of a grin, the scraping of a knee, adolescent thievery only ceasing when someone tells Coach Gardner, when the boys are handed 100 push-ups and a stern lecture, and somewhere along the way my envy. And summer is incubating somewhere inside us, already ready for cross country, which I hate, but I stay. Why do I stay? Like I think that sweet foolishness might rub off on me from these stealers of mangoes, those high school heroes. And look, the truth is, it's not that I wanted to be a boy. I just wanted to not be afraid for once. And that was A Memory. This one is Napalm Wishes It Burned As Bright As We Do. Vietnam did not want my Ong Noi alive, and I am my displaced father's daughter, asking all the questions he prayed he would never have to dance around. He calls himself a man without a country, our commonalities teaching me to separate depression from diaspora, denial from disillusion. Someday my daughter, too, will stand at the edge of an ocean and wonder at the distance. But until then, I tattoo Win onto my ribcage. Imagine it, a tether stretching out towards a country that does not want me. And if it stings, let it be because I want it to. Black ink on yellow skin instead of bombs. And let this name that I cannot pronounce correctly be nothing more than proof that surviving is our family heirloom. Let everyone here from here on out see that napalm wishes it burned as bright as me. And let this body be the war that my father won just by living long enough to give this Gon Lai his cafe soda stained smile. This next one is called Drought. It's a little long. Ask me why I hate summer, and I will tell you that summer is a drug I have been overdosing on my entire life, that I cannot call anyone a fair weather friend, because when you grow up in a place where people pray for a rainy day, that phrase doesn't mean jack shit. What I'm saying is that when the sun comes out, I want to crawl into the earth and stay there until it goes away. Ask me why I hate the sun, and I will tell you that I could have matched paint swatches to the yellow of the grass in my backyard, that I cannot remember a time before we were banned from running our sprinklers during the day. I once tried to keep a garden, woke up at 5 a.m. in the dark to water the cornflowers I had planted like a sweet 1 gallon secret. In a world of wilting browns and grays, I was dying for a splash of living color. If you want to know why I hate summer, it's because when I had to go away for 1 week, I came back to a hardened ground that crackled and cackled beneath my feet, and the flowers had turned up their faces. I didn't try again. My girlhood did not know a benevolent heat, only the kind that made preteen soccer players drop like dying flies. When you grow up in a drought, you learn that high school smells like burning rubber sneakers against black tar pavement, vomit curdling in empty bathrooms. And no, Jeremy, it doesn't matter how much Axe body spray you use. You still stink of sweat. We all stink of sweat. You cannot hide the parts of your body you hold with shame in sweaters and scarves when you grow up in a drought. Trust me, heat stroke's a bitch. You learn which way is east or west each year based on the news reports and where you can see or smell the smoke in the sky. Some months you pack a bag to keep by your door just in case. If you ask me why I fear a dry heat, it's because I know that heat is different than warmth. And you know, now that I think about it, it's no wonder I got so good at setting fire to myself. I had a lot of examples to follow. When I first moved here, the sheer amount of green overwhelmed me. The coolness and softness of it all. I had never seen anything so beautiful. I've learned to sleep with my windows open, to listen to the rain beat a tattoo against the streets. Ask me if this is a place I will stay, I cannot say, but I know it is a place I like to be. And when you smile at me, I swear I can feel the Southern California sky split wide open. And I go home and I call my mother. I tell her the drought is finally over, that I no longer need to wake up at 5 a.m. The flowers here know how to grow on their own. And now, so do I. That was Drought. This next one is called Colors. It's actually the first poem I ever did at Slamlandia when I first kind of got into Portland poetry. What's your favorite color, you ask? And it's odd because I haven't answered that question in what feels like years. Not since kindergarten, not since elementary school, when every binder and pencil case I owned was the same ugly sheet of fuchsia. So it catches me off guard when you say, what's your favorite color? It bothers me. And maybe I can blame it on the Malibu for the on-the-spot confusion, that split-second moment when I blurt out lilac without thinking, when you pause and say, that's a pretty color. You sound like you mean it, and I think maybe I mean it this time. What color does it feel like, you ask? And it's odd, because I am sitting on the couch, and this party I am throwing is spinning around me, and I feel I might throw up watching the cartoons projected on the wall, splashes of black and white light dancing. In the sea of people, I feel like someone has tied weights to my arms and legs, so it catches me off guard when you sit next to me. Like we are both on solid ground, and what color does it feel like? Gray, I say, a murky green, like being underwater, like swallowing salty jealousy, cutting my mouth on misplaced sadness. I don't know where it came from any more than I know what my favorite color is. Where is it in your body, you ask? And it's odd because it is 1 a.m. in a Holiday Inn Express hallway, and you are not looking at me because I asked you to. And maybe I can blame it on my own mortification, but you are refusing to leave me in my isolation is fucking infuriating, to say the least. You are not leaving me alone, even when I beg you to. Instead, where does it hurt, you ask, and I blurt out everywhere. In that split second, I have forgotten how to lie. You catch me off guard when you say I'm sorry, and that sounds scary, until my anxiety unties the anchor from my chest, until you hear it clank on the ground, until the hurt doesn't disappear, but maybe it's a little less bright, less frightening, less fuchsia, more like lilac. I never asked you the same questions. In the mirror, I ask, what color is it? Cloudy white, staticky, like steel wool. Where does it hurt? Inside my ribs, in the spaces between the bones of my fingers. It darkens to a yellow as it gravitates towards my stomach, pulling me down, down, down. And it's odd because you, who kept me on solid ground, won't look at me, and I won't ask you to. Stay. And there is nothing else I can blame but myself when these questions, without thinking, these questions come in your voice. The hurt you once helped me describe, these shades of drowning, they now sound a lot like you. That was Colors. This next one is called Love Letter to My Corner of the Universe. Oh gosh. Co-star advises me to try being open and vulnerable today. I take one look at it and go, ha, fuck that. My best friend thinks it's silly of me to believe in the stars only when they are telling me what I want to hear. She says that I cannot just ignore the parts I do not like, as though belief in something is an all-or-nothing thing. I'm told all-or-nothing thinking is something I excel at. And what is being vulnerable if not saying best friend, even in your own head without the assurance of reciprocation? What is it if not loving at the volume of a tree that falls in the forest with no one around to hear? You know, I want to believe that there is some order, some great plan to the universe. I don't know if I believe in God, but I believe in the man who trains therapy dogs by bringing them to my college campus, who hands out pieces of chicken and patience to every person who approaches with too much on their shoulders. I believe in the dog who does not yet know how to sit or stay or not nibble on my sleeves, but whose kindness shines in big brown eyes, never knowing the strength of his own gentleness. I believe in that. I believe in the line at Fred Meyer's when the woman ahead of me pays for the groceries in front of her and the teenagers getting high and seeing God in McDonald's across the street. I believe in hitting every green traffic light and the thoughts scribbled onto stop signs on the way home, stop. They still think of you. I want to thank the things that make up my universe. For Amanda making me breakfast before my first therapy appointment, for the Willamette River at night, for my bathroom shower, for holding onto my voice and throwing it back at me when I sing, for my memories, my first kiss, my first college party, when Sam brought a six-pack of cheap beer he got from his roommate's older brother, and Kai brought an entire pack of Rice Krispie treats because his roommate didn't have an older brother and he had no idea what else to bring, and they sat on the table for the entire night. I thank the universe for those stupid 18-year-old boys. I thank the universe that I can look at them now at another party and see them as they are and feel the bittersweetness of remembering who they were. Oh, I don't always want to remember because people are always leaving. But I want to thank the universe for letting them stay a while, for letting you stay a while. I want to thank the universe for the shape of my name in your mouth, the way the pitch of it throws me for a fucking loop. And what is the universe if not your hands? The way I feel as if I hold entire galaxies inside me whenever you enter the room, this too is a gift. the way my body feels whenever it is near yours, and what it, if what is what's meant to be, then what do the stars need when they align in every possible combination? And I am here, loving you. Even when we are no longer under the same sky, this is me still loving you at the same volume as a supernova. Riley reminds me that there is no sound in space, and I want to say that's the whole point. She thinks I should be vulnerable regardless of what CoStar says. In my head, I call her best friend. In reality, she says nothing when she finds me crying on the bathroom floor, simply throws the blades away and cleans up the blood, while the shower tiles echo my sobs. In reality, she doesn't drink shitty beer bought off college roommates or smoke in McDonald's parking lots. She doesn't like dogs, and she doesn't believe in the stars. But you know, I certainly believe in her. That was my love letter to the universe. This next one is called, oh gosh. This one is called My 15-Year-Old Self Writes the Cover Letter to Both My Resume and My Tinder Profile. I don't think I've ever done this one before, so this will be fun. Hello, future prospective employer / partner. I think you should hire / date Maddie for the following reasons. 1, she cannot tell the difference between work and love, and while this has not proven to have worked out well in the past, there is a kind of power in the continual optimism that maybe this time will be different. 2, she thinks blue M&Ms taste the best, and honestly, she's right. Also, she's allowed to drink and have sex now, and she's not still hung up on Mason Bourne from AP European History, so, you know, she's got that going for her. 3, she can count to 3, and she doesn't have to take calculus anymore. Apparently, they weren't lying when they said things get better after high school. 4, she's a hard worker, since she cannot tell the difference between work and love, and she's determined to always do what she loves, and that might just be you. 5, she's incredibly low maintenance, especially during the sad weeks when all she'll eat is coffee and saltine crackers, so operating costs are nearly non-existent. 6, if you play Hawaiian music around her at any point in time, she will probably cry or scream or swear at you, but some nights during the sad weeks when all she'll eat is coffee and saltine crackers, it might be the only thing that can get her to sleep. Please do not ask why. 7, she cannot tell the difference between love and work, but she has come to learn the difference between hurting and being hurt by, and she wants you to know that no one's ever hurt her on purpose. No one has ever hurt her on purpose. 8, change scares the hell out of her, so you should know that if you're going to hire / date her, she may never want to leave. 9, she knows that everything leaves eventually. 10, she knows you're probably going to ask her what her biggest weakness is, and it's that she watches Riverdale and actually enjoys it. 11, she didn't think she'd make it to 18, let alone 20, let alone 21. Some may say that this proves that she exceeds expectations when the expectations are her own. 12, she is always hoping you will start the conversation because you should know she will never start the conversation. She's ended too many conversations to ever have a hope of starting. Some may call this courtesy. 13, some may call her shy because she's too afraid of being called a bitch. 14, she calls herself lonely because she wants to be called loved. 15, she can count to 15, and she hopes things get better after college. And you should know that there is a kind of power in that continual optimism. In conclusion, I cannot tell the difference between work and love, and I don't think I want to, because anything worth having takes work. I write a college application essay for my 15-year-old self and tell her to be gentle, that the job will come, that the love will come and go, and I tell her next time things will be different. And that was called My 15-Year-Old Self Writes My Cover Letter and Tinder Profile. This next one is called Souvenirs. It's the first poem I wrote in 2020, actually. a trinket stall in Hoi An, I am paralyzed by the impermanence of keychains and plastic fans in shot glasses stamped with yellow stars. I told my friends in a moment of the smug, self-assured pride that travelers often possess that I would bring them back gifts from Vietnam, but you see, I don't want to give them something they could lose or easily break. And maybe if I were better at words, I'd be able to recognize the metaphor in this, the wanting to give the people I like something that will last the test of time, because 10,000 dong is the going rate for one of those plastic fans. A pink bill with Ho Chi Minh's face handed over, a continent away across an ocean, my friend will accept it with a smile, put it in her closet, and maybe in a decade or so, she'll be cleaning something out and stumble over it. Maybe she'll brush off the years and dust that accumulated on this cheap knickknack and let it creak something open in her memories, the rusted overthought of a girl who once loved her from halfway across the world. Or maybe she'll throw it out. Either way, it makes me sad to think about, so I don't buy the fan. I want to give you something that will last longer than the time it takes for me to leave this country, longer than the time it takes for me to leave your thoughts. I want to give you something that will last when it's time for you to leave, because, of course, you always will. I want to give you the humidity that soaked my hair and drenched my clothes within minutes of stepping outside. I want to give you the sand that stung my lugs, the salt taste in my mouth, a street lined with spices and baskets of fruit carried on the shoulders of women with faces the same as mine. And if I give you this, will you always remember what I looked like? I want to give you all the stars I could not see so close to the equator, but instead the paper lanterns in the water sparkling like candles, like dragons. And I don't want to buy you a cheap plastic dragon-shaped pipe. Don't want to shove it in your hands and call it love. I want you to live inside all the pictures I never took, to be here and remember with me. I want you like the strong and sweet coffee I sipped every morning. I want you to be here to play with me in this trinket stall in Hoi An. My heart is breaking, which in this country just means history. Halfway across the world, the weight of this love and longing heavier than this Vietnamese, like broken teeth in my mouth. Em Nhiel An, I miss you. The trinket stall in Hoi An misses you. So I send you a postcard littered with curse words and stamps with Ho Chi Minh's face. I don't say, I wish you were here, because God, what a cliche. What a shitty souvenir. That was souvenirs. Oh gosh. This next one is called Palm to Palm is Holy Palmer's Kiss. Big guess of about what that's about. It is 1 a.m. and I am thinking about your hands. Specifically, I am thinking about your left hand lying on top of my thigh in early February, and me matching you shot for shot at a party that shrinks, slowly diminishes until all that remains is your voice, your breath, your left hand. I'm thinking about your hands in early March, my own pressed between them like a flower pressed between the pages of a script, you kissing me quick, you kiss by the book, us shifting, sending your sin back and forth, your lips on my right hand, your eyes seeing the streaks of daylight before I can even rise from where I lie. On stage, you say your lines differently this time. It is 1 a.m. and I am thinking about the irony of me constantly comparing us to Romeo and Juliet, knowing exactly how that ends, DiCaprio in a Hawaiian shirt, 3 days and six dead, thinking that if I love you as much as I do, I should want something else instead. Knowing that you know this too, that we have spent countless afternoons rehearsing in windowless rooms. Knowing this, thinking I should know better than to mix up the nightingales and larks, that I shouldn't know what you look like in the dark of your skin against mine. You broke the rules in a game we weren't supposed to take off stage. You see, you lose things if you're not careful. I'm thinking about your right hand. I'm thinking about your fingers curled around my wrist, the space between your thumb and forefinger, the space inside me reaching, your smile against my thigh, my love against your indifference, and oh, brawling love, oh, loving hate, I hate that I am thinking about your hands and how much I miss them. About your left hand, when you left, you had no idea that when you ask me how things are in Portland, I am thinking that Mantua is cold this time of year. When you say, let's FaceTime soon, I am thinking of a letter that will never arrive. And the opposite of love is distance. And did you know your father friended me on Facebook? And I know our story has long since played out. The curtains have closed in more ways than one. And yet it is still 1 a.m. I smoke on the back porch and play ukulele music. Think somewhere over the rainbow there you are and listen. Some days I feel like a half-written sonnet, still waiting to be finished. Where's the next one? Where did it go? This next one is called Skim. The boy I love is teaching me how to skip stones. An important lesson they don't teach in school. If he were smarter, he would know that this is an opportunity, that what I want is for him to teach me, using my body as a diagram to move the way he wants. If he paid a little more attention, he would know that I am begging for the curl of his fingers around my wrist, where the skin is soft and prickles empty for it, waiting. Instead, my boyfriend says I am not bending low enough and tells me to pull my arm back further. And he does not touch me. Not at all. Not at all. That fall, I practice looking for rocks that are wide and flat enough and carry them home in my pocket. I do not tell the boy who loves me that I am practicing the art of throwing things into rivers, hoping against hope that they will suspend their sinking long enough for it to count. And here's the thing they don't teach you in school, that love can sink like a stone with the wrong flick of a wrist. But if you turn your eyes away for just a second, it can disappear beneath the waves. That spring, I fill my pockets with stones and walk 2 miles every other day to Cathedral Park, sometimes in the dark, most of the times in the dark. I imagine the ghost of the girl who was stabbed under the St. John's Bridge standing beside me, and she tells me, pockets heavy, to bend lower, to ignore the ducks treading water, that they know nothing, that no one has ever loved like me. And what they don't teach you in school is that when you're unsure of what weighted absence you are grieving, it tends to stack and fold onto each other until everything is submerged and the Willamette is the color of ink and cold. The dead girl has a point, I think. I pull my arm back further, flick my wrist, and try to teach myself the art of letting go. That summer on Princeton Street, I stoop to scoop up a stone, tell a different boy that I love, despite not wanting to, that I made it to 4 skips the other day, that I have kept what is meant to sink floating, if just for another moment. The boy, who does not love me, tells me that he still can't believe I'd walk all the way to the river, what the distance means to him. I want to tell him what I mean when I say stone, what I mean when I say float, that he really has no idea how far. Not at all. Not at all. That was called Skim. This next one where is it? Where did it go? It was written at the very beginning of quarantine. It's called Looking Back at Your Cooking, You Somehow Added Too Much Salt. Also written for National Poetry Writing Month. Here is a poem about hate. Here's a poem about me hating you. Here's a poem about the fact that I hate when I am in line at Fred Meyer's, trying my best to stay 6 feet away from every person in sight. All I can think about is you. How once, after a fight with my mom, you took me grocery shopping and dangled a zucchini in its bag from your wrist, back and forth, like a child swinging high on a playground and then letting go. You sent the vegetable flying and went after it with a shit-eating grin. I hate that I am thinking about that moment in this crowd of shoppers, where a man standing over by the squash is staring at me, where I am lowering my wrongly shaped eyes to the ground. I hate that you threw a zucchini in a Safeway and then told me I didn't owe my mother anything. I hate that you always knew what to say. I hate that you know how much words mean to me, that you don't like poetry but read mine anyway. I hate that since you left, you've been all I can write about, some teenage cliche, 10 things I hate about you. I hate that I told you I loved you 2 days before a pandemic broke. And now I have an excuse never to say it again, because you want to know what happened the last time I was vulnerable? The effing plague. I hate that you held on to that. I hate that you know how much words mean to me, but still said I need some time. How much time does it take to throw a vegetable back across the sea? To tell me no, I'm sorry. I hate you because this isolation is getting to me. And you know how much I hate to be alone. For my birthday, I asked for a smile. I thought, please tell me you don't love me. You don't love me back. Vaccinate me. Help me make my poetry a lot less shitty than it's been lately. I don't want to compare you to a virus or my heart to a vegetable forever swinging from your hand. Please give me something. In this Fred Meyers, I am hating you more than the man by the squash, more than my job, more than the face mask making me dizzy as I breathe in and out, and in my memory, I watch you drop the zucchini. Watch your shoulders slump, but the smile start looking at me to see if I'll laugh. And I laugh and laugh and laugh. That was looking back at your cooking. You somehow added too much salt. Then I have one more, I think. Would that be okay? Okay. This is called For Megan in Our Kitchen. While you scramble the eggs, I dilute my coffee with whipped cream because we are in quarantine and out of the fake liquid sugar that comes in the red-capped bottle. And you dance around in your fuzzy socks with headphones on while I lean up against our limited counter outer space and wonder, how did I get here? To slice the bread I have baked, to hand you a butter knife like a scalpel, a winking surgery for breakfast, and the sunlight dripping in through our window through the bamboo plants on our sill, and our roommate texting to ask if we're out of toilet paper, and we're not just yet. The world is dying outside, and yet you are still frying bacon, our grocery list on the fridge bleeding Expo marker red onto my fingers, my hair wet and cold from the shower, and I have bills to pay and a job I loathe, but how did I get here, warmed in the nucleus of a star I get to call home? How did I get so lucky to be pulled out of orbit? That was For Megan in Our Kitchen.
This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. And my guest this month is Maddie Nguyen. Maddie, what brought you to Portland?
School, actually. I grew up in Southern California and did not like it there. So when I graduated high school, I said I'd go anywhere but California. And I got in University of Portland.
And you wrote about drought and Portland being a much wetter and greener place, obviously, than Southern California. And we've seen in the last year that Metro Portland can also be subject to drought and, at least indirectly, the effects of wildfire. Do you feel like that's reflecting into your writing?
Yeah, this summer was kind of awful, honestly. With the wildfires happening near Portland, there was definitely a lot of callback to when I was a kid and always being afraid of like evacuation zones, and it was definitely a callback. And I think at the time I was so panicked I didn't even consider writing about it. It was just like, but looking back, I think it would be definitely something to explore. That's really fascinating, especially in terms of like climate change and whether or not there is really any safe places anymore, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you end up writing poetry?
I've always found writing to be a kind of catharsis. I wrote prose when I was very little. I wrote, you know, your high school, middle school, I think this boy is cute kind of poetry. I had a deviant art when I was a kid. God, I'm never going to look for that again. And then last summer, the summer of 2019, I took a trip to Vietnam, which was fun. It was also for some, and I remember I was very anxious for some reason. And for some reason, I decided to listen to a bunch of slam poetry. In particular, I listened to When Love Arrives by Sarah Kay. And I found it really soothing, and I found it also like very cathartic to write in a way, kind of free writing, you know, a bit. Yeah, and so then when I got back to Portland, I attended Slamlandia just with the poem I wrote, Colors. That was just me taking a really just organizing my thoughts on a relationship that had ended or was in the process of ending. I found it really helpful to process what felt like a really chaotic time regarding interpersonal relationships. And so, yeah, I started writing poetry at a time in my life when there was a lot of things going on. And in doing so, it became a way for me to process those things.
Have you had any, excuse me, have you had any formal instruction?
Not really. I took a poetry course my last semester of college. It was just like a poetry survey where we analyzed different poets and their styles. I wrote some for that course. So like I do have an understanding of like various rules and forms. But I've never like taken a class specifically for the writing of poetry itself. That was just more of like analyzing the history and the rules and the, yeah.
Are there any writers out there that you would consider a particular influence on you?
Yeah, I adore Olivia Gatwood. I think it was like a TED Talk or something. She spoke about specificity in poetry and how that conjures the specificity in poetry makes it stronger in a way. How it conjures, it kind of relates back to what that quote. It says you can write about war or you can write about the child's shoe and how that kind of, I'm sorry, I'm not articulating it correctly, but that's just always stuck out to me is what she says about specificity and that how that reflects also in her poetry when she's writing about like, you know, things that have happened in her life. Mm-hmm. I love Ocean Vuong. I love what he does with language. I'm coming from Vietnam. There's a specific passage from On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous where he talks about the Vietnamese word for remembering and missing is the same and how he explores that. I nerd out about like linguistics and things like that. I also just really enjoy, I wouldn't say it's like an influence on me, but I just genuinely enjoy Robert Burns. I guess because like he is like, he, what's it called? Preserved the Scottish way of speaking and how that reflected. Yeah, I think that also goes back to specificity and how, like, poets who write poems that only they could write.
Right.
Kind of,
I mean,
yeah.
he's got terrific rhythm, but sometimes if you read it in normal English, then the rhythm's wrong because that's not
Yeah.
how it's spoken.
Yeah. And I like that. I like that it comes from such a personal place for all of those poets.
And you used some Vietnamese words in your poem, Napalm Wishes It Burned As Brightly As Us. Do you consider yourself bilingual or is it just a little bit?
Not in Vietnamese. I have taken Spanish, German, French for in school. I've never taken like a Vietnamese class. I've tried multiple times throughout my life to teach myself it, whether it's through Rosetta Stone or Duolingo, or just yeah, cobbling it together, trying to. It's Vietnamese is a very difficult language because it's tonal. And I was not taught it as a child. I do my best. I can maybe get across that my Vietnamese is very bad in Vietnamese. I can tell my grandparents, like, oh, I'm hungry and things like that. I would not say I can carry on like a decent conversation in Vietnamese, which also comes up in my poetry when I say like, my own broken Vietnamese, heavy in my mouth, kind of thing, which, it's another diaspora poem.
So, do you find the slam scene in Portland pretty accessible?
I do. It was always like, it's especially during COVID, it's had to move to like an online format. I think. And I'm guilty of having kind of not dropped out of it. Like, I still follow along with it, but I have definitely not been attending as many events as I did when they were in person. In pre-COVID times, I always found them very enjoyable, very, I personally found them, like, in terms of like, I can't speaking as like an able-bodied cisgendered woman, I found them personally accessible. I felt like I was really nervous my first day going to Slamlandia, like, 21 years old who could barely like be in the bar. I mean, no, I could have been there. It wasn't like a bar. It was like a, but like, I was 21 years old, never read poetry in front of anyone before, having to get up in front of the mic. I was really nervous, but the people were just really supportive. Julia, who runs Slamlandia, was a real, like, I look up to her a lot. Yeah, I kept going back for a reason.
Well, that's great. Do you feel like the people you see in the slams, not only the performers, but the audience, are they fairly representative of Portland as a whole, or are they different in age and race and gender?
I would say so. I'm trying to think back. I would say so. Yeah. Gender-wise, age. I do think I tend, if I'm trying to recall correctly, I think I do tend to be on the younger. So, no, that's not correct. I think age, yeah, there's a good mix. In terms of ethnicity, I mean, Portland is pretty white city. That's not like an excuse, but like, I would say there are a handful of people of color who do show up. I would say, I Yeah, I would say it does not. It doesn't feel unwelcoming as a person of color there, if that makes any sense. It's never occurred to me as a monolith kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm not meaning to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Making you recite percentages or anything like that.
Yeah, for sure.
So how is the SLAM community managing with the isolation? Has it adapted pretty well to online formats, or are people fatigued and discouraged?
I'm unsure if I'm the best person to speak to that, because again, I attend a lot less than I used to. So I guess I think I definitely experienced Zoom fatigue at the very beginning of quarantine, when everyone was like, oh, we can just, you know, keep our social engagements the same. They just go online. And then when everyone tried doing that, it got worn out pretty quickly. But I do know that Samlandia and Portland Poetry Slam are still going. I see their events every week. I don't know much about the participation level, but I do know that people are still creating, just based off what I've seen from people I know in the community.
Well, that's good to hear. So now, because I always end with a completely random question, what's a food you've always wanted to try and why?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I would say, what's that, like, sandwich cookie?
Macaroons?
Macaroons kind of thing. Yeah, the ones that are, like, come in different colors and they look like sandwiches. I want to try them, but I have a severe tree nut allergy. Allergy. I actually was in the hospital last night for it.
Oh.
But yeah, I'm fine now. But yeah, I can't eat tree nuts, and a lot of the times they're made with almond flour. So
right.
Yeah, but everyone seems to love them, and they're so pretty. And I'm just like, I want to know what they taste like.
Well, that's too bad. I wonder if there are any like alternative recipes for those.
Yeah. Maybe.
With that. All right. Well, thank you. This has been very lovely. And you're listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO Portland, KBOO 90.7 FM. My guest this month was Maddie Nguyen. And as always, stay safe, and we'll talk to you again next month.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
A cat named Joe. He wears a red bandana, plays a blues piano. Said just be cool. He wears a red bandana, plays a blues piano. From a bongo lick, the joint was swinging on a Latin kick. I didn't know exactly what to do.
expect? Joe threw his suntanned arms around my neck. We started dancing all around the floor, and then he did a dance I never saw before. So if you're south of the border, I mean down in Mexico, and
you are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Thank you, KBOO supporters, for helping us reach our end-of-the-year fundraising goal. KBOO only exists because of you,